Writing of a structure at scale is hard. It's messy, it's complicated, and it has a tendency to go sideways in the middle of the night. Rather than talk about the idealized versions of things, we're going to talk about the rough edges. We're going to talk about what it's really like running infrastructure at scale. Welcome to the Real World DevOps Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Julian, editor and analyst for Monitoring Weekly and author of O'Reilly's Practical Monitoring. This episode is sponsored by the lovely folks at Influx Data. If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably also interested in better monitoring tools, and that's where Influx comes in. Personally, I'm a huge fan of their products, and I often recommend them to my own clients. You're probably familiar with their time series database, InfluxDB, but you may not be as familiar with their other tools. Telegraph for metrics collection from systems, Chronograph for visualization, and Capacitor for real-time streaming. All of this is available as open source, and they also have a hosted commercial version, too. You can check all of this out at influxdata.com. Hi, folks. I'm Mike Julian, your host for the Real World DevOps Podcast. I'm here with Dr. Sherry Walling, clinical psychologist, author, and fellow podcaster at zenfounder.com. Welcome to the show, Sherry.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Mike. After a couple of reschedules, I'm glad we finally got this together.
It was a bit of work to make that happen, but I'm really excited about this episode. So, Sherry, why don't you start off by just telling us a bit about who you are and what you do?
Yeah. So, like you said, I'm a clinical psychologist, and I have spent my professional life working with people who have high intensity jobs. So that's looked like a couple different things over the course of my career. Sometimes it's with folks in the military, returning from military service. I've worked a lot with physicians who have high intensity work, either in the ER or in surgery. And then I actually work a lot with software entrepreneurs and software folks. My connection to the developer world is largely through my husband, Rob Walling, who maybe some of your audience know of MicroConf and things like that. But so I work with really smart people who are trying to do really hard things and often have a lot of pressure in their work lives.
Yeah, that's that's some awesome stuff. And the reason I'm especially interested in talking to you is as DevOps engineers, we lead extraordinarily stressful lives. A day in the life of a operations engineer we're project driven, and yet it's often interrupt heavy. So we're never really finishing anything thanks to putting out fires constantly. Just so many fires, it's all the time. Everything is always awful. Everything's just a tire fire everywhere we look. So we're responsible for keeping systems of like multi-million dollar or sometimes multi-billion dollar companies running and available. And on call is a standard part of the job. And sometimes this is really bad. Like the on call rotations of some companies might be 15 pages a night for a week or 2 weeks at a time. And it just gets insane. So, and this is not just like a few years or one job. This is like an entire career. So to say that the role of an ops engineer is stressed is kind of an understatement. So I'm really excited to talk to you about how can we manage this stress? Like, is there something we can do about it? How can we improve our lives?
Well, I'm really empathizing with the way that you're describing this. And there's a couple of things that you said that would lead me to believe that folks who are doing this kind of work are really at pretty high risk for burnout. Whenever there's high work demand, so lots of things to do, without having appropriately accomplishable goals, right? Goals that have a tight timeline and clear successes. Those three things tend to be a combination that really causes burnout in a lot of folks. So I can empathize with the amount of stress that folks are feeling, and certainly guessing that some of your listeners are really struggling at this point with stress-related difficulties or things like burnout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Why don't we just start with burnout? Like, there's so many different ways that I want to tackle this conversation, but why don't we just start with burnout? What is burnout?
Yeah, so burnout is a newly recognized clinical syndrome. So it has its own diagnostic code. It is a real thing.
That's fantastic. It is about time.
It exists in the ICD-10, which is the International Classification of Disorders 10. And it's called something like burnout, a state of vital exhaustion is the technical title, which I think is really sort of lovely language that sort of paints the picture of what this feels like, vital exhaustion. So burnout is something that was researched by Christina Maslach, a psychologist at UC Berkeley, and she spent her whole career, like 40-something years, really developing this and researching it thoroughly. And burnout really has three components, and it's a sense of, first of all, emotional and physical exhaustion. So people are just tired. They're physically tired. They might have a cold that they just can't recover from. Their bodies are broken down and worn out. And then emotionally exhausted, which can look like kind of like depression, like flat, apathetic, not a lot of oomph or passion. So physical and emotional exhaustion is number one. The second component of burnout is feeling detached or cynical. So this really is where you feel like the work that you were doing doesn't have a lot of value, and the people that you are serving or working with are just irritating the hell out of you. You know, you sort of like don't care so much as maybe you used to about what it is you're trying to accomplish. You don't find it rewarding or meaningful. And then the third component that's used to sort of technically diagnose burnout is a lack of personal efficacy. So feeling like no matter how hard you work or what accomplishments you might be able to brag about, it feels like you're not getting anything meaningful done. You're just not pushing the needle forward, or you're not able to sort of push the boulder up the hill. So burnout is specific, and it is specific to how someone is doing in their mental health in relationship to their job. So you don't get burnt out from being like in a crummy relationship with a girlfriend or boyfriend. Like, you have other problems perhaps, but right. Burnout is very specific to your job.
Man, I'm just having flashbacks to so many jobs where I was checking the boxes on all three of those pretty hard. Mm. Is burnout inevitable? Like, is it just going to happen when we're having these stressful jobs?
Yeah, some of the epidemiological studies suggest that it's between 25 and 30% of adults experience burnout in a given year. So it's really common.
That sounds terrible.
A lot of people experience it. And that stats from the US, and then there's a similar study for the UK. It's not inevitable in the sense that there are some things that protect people from burnout, even in really high intensity jobs. So again, some of the folks that I've worked with over the years, some of them do incredibly difficult, really hard, stressful things, but they do okay. So it's not inevitable, but it depends a lot on how much control you have over your work environment and then what you're doing in the other parts of your life to help protect yourself from burnout.
So that's a fantastic point. When I went through a super bad case of burnout some years ago, and I had realized that during the course of this, I found a book. It's called Play It Away by Charlie Hone. And it's a fantastic book about his experiences with burnout. But one of the things that he really talked about was he had realized he stopped hanging out with friends. He had stopped doing hobbies. But all this stuff kind of crept up on him. It wasn't an immediate thing. It wasn't like, oh, you know what? Screw my friends. I'm not going to talk to them anymore. It was like over the span of, say, 6 months or a year, you realize looking back that you haven't had dinner with a friend in a while. Mm-hmm. Like, you haven't had dinner with any friends in a while. So it kind of comes up on you slowly. Is that part of your experience as well?
Yeah, I think that's very true. It's kind of a slippery slope. You know, most of us start our work feeling pretty positive or pretty ambitious about what we're going to get done and how we're going to contribute to the world. And then over time, some of that optimism and energy just gets kind of eroded away. Mm-hmm. And hanging out with people, having strong social connections is one of the most important protective factors that helps prevent burnout. Some of the other ones are being able to celebrate successes, which I hear is sort of hard in your community when you have all these projects and you don't, like, there's not a point where it's like, okay, it's done. But when you do have those projects that ship, when you are finished with something, taking the time to really celebrate that and let your brain on a neurological level feel the positive chemicals that come along with the satisfaction of finishing something. Mm-hmm. People don't do that very often or do that very well, but it's really important.
Yeah, I've seen someone, it's actually a whole bunch of people now, have a practice of every minor win, like no matter how small it is, they celebrate with a cupcake to themselves. And
love it.
At first I thought like, no, like I want to save that for something big. And then I realized, no, actually you can't. Like, we don't often get big wins and we can't ever predict when they're going to come. So you celebrate the wins as you get them.
Yeah, there's all kinds of different ways that people can do that, whether that's like, you know, a lot of people do it with food or sweets or a special drink, you know, having a bottle of wine that you sort of write a sticky note and you say, like, I will drink this bottle of wine or open this wine when I finish this project or when this thing launches or something like that. Having those designations, both for short-term goals and bigger goals, is helpful. You might have a cupcake a week, sort of on a weekly reward schedule, but then give yourself a bigger treat when something bigger is accomplished.
Yeah, I love it. So we've talked about a couple different ways to mitigate and detect when you might be burning out or have already crossed that threshold. Are there any others?
One of the most important things that helps protect people from burnout is feeling attached to the meaningfulness of their work, like really having a strong sense of, I'm going to do a good job writing this email or fixing this problem because it is ultimately meaningful to my customer, to my community, to my business, to my whatever. People sort of define that in lots of different ways. But the bigger the gap between what you're doing on a daily basis and what you find meaningful, the more vulnerable you are to burnout.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like, it's hard to get excited about being a system administrator for ad networks. Like,
I don't know. Maybe, I mean, is it an interesting problem to solve? Is it sort of like intellectually interesting?
Yeah, for me, I don't think I could do it. Like, it's just nowhere near my interest. And I think there's a lot of people that are listening that have the work that they're doing is not that interesting to them, whether it's not intellectually challenging or they don't like the company they actually work for, like they don't agree with them from a philosophical standpoint. The gap may be pretty big.
Yeah.
What are some ways to deal with that?
So you do have to kind of listen to yourself to how tolerable it is. But one thing is to make sure that you're really optimizing for meaning in other parts of your life. You know, you do the 9-to-5, you collect the paycheck, and that paycheck allows you to live the life that you want to live. And so you have other parts of your life that you find deeply meaningful, which sort of offset the not super meaningful part of your 9-to-5. I don't love to like leave people there for years on end. I don't think that's a recipe for a satisfying, healthy life over the long run. But I think we all go through seasons where we're like, I could take or leave this day job, but yeah. Hey, at least that I can afford my model train hobby or the great vacation I'm taking with my husband or wife.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like that one might be it's not a long-term strategy, but more of a short-term strategy to get your mind back on track, to even bring yourself closer back to being healthy so that you can think about longer-term solutions.
Yeah.
And in that situation, a long-term solution might be get a new job.
Yeah, sure. And I think one of the ways that we can reconnect with meaning is to notice what we're grateful for, especially if we're bummed out about what's happening at work. It can be a really helpful practice to, you know, at the end of each day or some point of your day, just jot down 3 to 5 things that you are grateful for, that you are happy about in your life. That sounds maybe like a little bit hippy-dippy or touchy-feely or something, but there's actually a tremendous body of research behind the psychological benefits of a simple practice like that.
I had the pleasure of seeing Sean Acker speak, I guess, last year, and I think he wrote the book The Happiness Project. I think that was the name of it. And he talked about this body of research, and he was basically going around to companies and saying, let me practice on your team. What we're going to do is... gratitude journals was one of the things he did. We're going to have everyone on your team every morning. They're going to write down 3 things they're grateful for. And then we're going to measure before this project and after this project, how they feel about the work they're doing. And we're just going to measure it by asking them, like, how do you feel about your job? How do you feel about your life? And he says there were noticeable improvements despite the job not changing. And everywhere he went, he repeated the study and it just kept coming out that same way. And what essentially the research is saying, you are happy when you think you're happy. Like, you can choose to be happy.
That our emotions are largely a state of mind. But I say that somewhat gently, because I do think that that can also lead to some frustration on the part of friends and family of those who are in burnout or who are experiencing something like depression, to say, like, just pull yourself together. You can choose this.
Right.
Because it's certainly not that straightforward.
Yeah, absolutely. It is. That is probably the hardest part of this, of like, you're with a friend and like they've just lost a loved one, and all you have to say is choose to be happy. Like, yeah, that's not going to get anyone anywhere. Like, yeah. That's awful.
And so I think the gratitude work is really important in protecting against burnout and in part of the recovery from burnout. But when someone is really, truly in the midst of burnout, there begin to be these neurological changes in their brain. So their amygdala, which is sort of the fear center, becomes overly active and really floods the system with cortisol.
That's interesting.
So there, we can measure changes in the brain. The other part of that that happens that's really problematic is that the connections between the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex, which is where we make all of our, you know, fancy human decisions and plans,
mm-hmm.
Those connections begin to weaken, which means that the skills that we would use to talk ourselves through our feelings or to even actively choose a different way of feeling, those resources become much less available to us on a brain level when we're in the midst of burnout. We see neurons begin to die that connect those kind of brain circuitry that help us to, you know, choose our way of feeling. So again, if you're sitting with somebody who's in burnout and you're like, can you just pull yourself together, please? Like, oh my God, like, why are you choosing to be miserable? It may be that they've gotten kind of so far down this path that they're really impaired in their brain's ability to make a choice mm-hmm. about how they feel. And at that point, people really often do need to take a pretty significant rest so that the brain can begin to repair itself. And that can also happen. It's not sort of a death sentence for your neurological health to be burnt out. There's possibility to bounce back.
That's exactly what happened to me. I was so far down the burnout hole that I snapped at a coworker one day, which is like, is not me. And it was pretty bad. The guy nearly started to cry, and like my boss called me and he's like, what did you do?
Mm-hmm.
And like, he's like, you take the weekend off because we need to have a chat. And I decided I was going to leave the company. Like, after the weekend, I'm like, I got to go. I got to leave. And he's like, so where are you going to go? Well, I'm going to a remote beach in Costa Rica. And he's like, is that a euphemism for another company I'm not aware of? I'm like, no, it's actually a remote beach in Costa Rica. And I stayed there for months. Like, mm-hmm. I just sat around doing nothing. Just the very idea of being on a computer it made me nervous, made me anxious.
Yeah. Well, you're perfectly like representing sort of what often needs to happen when people need to recover from burnout. It's usually a minimum of 2 weeks of really deep rest. Sounds like you were able to take more time than that, which is great and perfect. Oh, and I wish we had sabbaticals, right? So I used to be an academic, and every 7 years you apply for sabbatical, mm-hmm. and you don't just like, you know, go lay on a beach somewhere, although you can. You work on a project, you're learning something, you're writing something, you're sort of bringing new life into your academic or your intellectual career. And I wish that sort of all careers had that, because I think all thought workers could really use that kind of like 3 to 5 months off to just reset.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. That sounds fantastic. So for those, we kind of have two problems here. One is for those people that are so far deep down into this and they can't take that time off.
Yeah.
And then we have the people who are maybe not quite that far down, but they're feeling the effects of burnout. So it sounds like the solutions to these two are different solutions.
Rest is always helpful. Relationships are always helpful. Even if you can't do weeks off rest, you can do evenings where you're not working unless you're on call, or weekends when you're technology free, obviously unless you're on call.
Mm-hmm.
But taking clean breaks as much as you can. So rest is always helpful. Relationships are always helpful. creating or connecting to as much meaning in your life is always helpful. Celebrating any rewards that are, or any positive things that are happening is always helpful. Setting clear goals for yourself is always helpful. Even in someone who's burnt out, maybe the goal is like, I'm going to read 3 non-technical books, or I'm going to have coffee with 3 friends in the next month. So you have that sense of, here's what I'm setting out for myself and here's what I'm chipping away at.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot more sense. So it's not just like, nope, everyone has to go take 4 months off now. You really can have smaller things that you can do no matter what your situation is. So for some people, it might just be set a strict work schedule. Like, yes, your company, you have been working for your company 60 plus hour weeks. Cut that down to 40, in like a strict 40.
Mm-hmm.
So say 5 or 6 p.m. every night, stop working.
I think, you know, it's tough in the field that you're in because this sort of around the clock or mostly around the clock expectation for work availability is really, really contraindicated for human mental health.
yes.
And I will say that, you know, of course, in the United States and to some extent in the UK, or I'm sorry, in the EU, depression is the number one driver of disability in the U.S. Most people who are missing work or who are taking large chunks of time off work are because of depression, which of course sort of overlays with burnout and other things. Mm-hmm. So this is a really deep problem. And so I do think that those of us who have positions where we have some power to advocate for changes in our work environments, like, this is a worthy cause to take up, because 60 hour work weeks of it being on call over the weekend, that's fine for a short duration. But if that is your work life forever without significant breaks, that's, you know, that's almost always a recipe for really significant trouble.
Mm-hmm. So let's look at it from the perspective of a concerned friend or family member. If I have a friend who I know is burnt out, but they don't agree, but I see all the signs, what can I do to help them?
You know, I think it's hard when you're having a conversation with someone and they just flat out disagree.
Right.
I think when we use language like, hey, I'm concerned about you, it seems like you're really carrying a lot right now. Or, wow, you've been working so many hours. How are you holding up? You know, I think when we use this more neutral language that expresses how we feel, but isn't like sort of finger wagging at someone.
Not accusatory.
Yeah. Or not pathologizing, mm-hmm. not saying like, wow, you seem really depressed. Like, nobody, you look really tired. Like, nobody wants to hear that. I think to some extent, when we drop the seeds of like, hey, I've been just talking with a lot of folks lately who are really burnt out. I've certainly been really burnt out. I see how hard you're working. I worry about that for you. You know, that those kinds of sentences are, they normalize it. You're not mm-hmm. being like, wow, you're weak, you're lazy, or whatever. You're also telling your story or sharing vulnerably, but like not in this way that's not invited. You're not lecturing. So I think the way that we approach the conversation is very important. And sometimes you're a squeaky wheel a little bit, especially if someone just disagrees with you.
Right. Could there be something like very simple steps that I could take of, so the suggestions on wording and like how to approach a conversation would be super helpful. But you've also mentioned that having friends, having hobbies, having relationships in general is also very helpful on this. So if I have a friend who is consistently bowing out of going to some event with me, going out for coffee in exchange for doing work, how can I handle that? Like, how can I kind of pull them out of that, pull them out of the hole?
I think consistently showing up and meeting people where they are. You know, I think when someone is really in a bad state, maybe they're at their house and they're on their laptop all evening, maybe you just drop by, bring some guac and chips, and just sit with them. Maybe you're on your laptop too. It's not like a deeply communicative interaction,
right.
But just feeling the presence of another person can be really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Also suggesting things like, let's just walk around the block for, you know, we don't have to have a 2-hour hangout. Like, let's just walk around the block for a couple minutes. I'll pop by and then I'll go and you can finish your work.
Yeah.
So being a little bit pushy in a graceful way and respecting that you, I mean, even me as a professional helper, I can't force people to do more than they are ready to do, period. Right. You can show up, you can drop hints, you can make it easy, you can be available, you can give resources, but you have to wait for people where they are, which is really hard.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, especially when it's someone you care about and watching what they're going through, it's hard to sit there and know that you can't cause them to be better. You can't make their situation better yourself. It's they have to do it. You can help, but sometimes all you can do is just watch and be there.
Yep. And hanging around, dropping by with a snack. Those are pretty powerful things. They don't feel like we're doing much,
right. But
they're pretty powerful. And again, when someone's feeling bad, sometimes a 10-minute conversation is all that's really tolerable.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's talk about post burnout. When I've recovered from my own burnout, the thing that was on my mind was I want a stress-free life. Because it's kind of like the extreme reaction to what I'd just come out of. And, you know, sitting on a beach in Costa Rica is pretty stress-free.
I don't know. There's some big iguanas I've seen there down in Manuel Antonio.
That's true. They are huge.
That's a little stressful.
That was a little stressful the first day I was there because you wake up and it's like 6 a.m. and there's iguanas running across the tin roof. But you have no idea what they are because, like, it's your first day there, so you're like, what the hell is on the roof? Is it going to eat me?
So maybe.
That was a little stressful. So for me, when I came back from this and I thought, I want a stress-free life, and I very quickly realized that, you know, that's actually kind of a bad thing. I got really bored.
Yeah.
That led me to this question of, is all stress bad? Like, what's your experience with that? Is there a balance? Is there a such thing as a good stress?
Absolutely.
Okay, yeah. So what does that mean? Like, what is the difference between good stress and bad stress? How do I tell the difference?
Well, this is going to sound so geeky. I'm sorry.
Please, have at
it. I'd like to quote the Yerkes-Dodson principle. So there is this old school psychology 101 study looking at the relationship between stress and performance. And it's called the Yerkes-Dodson principle. And it's a beautiful inverted U. So it says that as stress rises, performance also rises. But when stress becomes sort of past the tipping point or past the midpoint, then performance begins to drop. You can sort of picture that inverted U in your head, maybe. Stress is simply a measure of, physiologically, it's a measure of activation. So stress feels very much like excitement, very much like passion. It's the same part of our bodies that are like, woohoo, we're awake, we're wired. So stress is motivating. Stress helps us feel keyed up and awake and focused. So like you're identifying, like no stress means we're really not sort of fully awake or functioning at any level of sort of intellectual or physiological stimulation. Like we're just kind of like existing.
Mm-hmm.
But the magic is finding the point at which your stress helps you and really being wise about the point at which your stress becomes too much and it starts to inhibit your ability to, you know, do a complicated task or be a kind person.
Yeah. When I came back from this, from my sabbatical, and I took a job that was very low stress. And like, it was very intentional. I took a job that was slightly lower paying, but had much, much lower stress levels. But I wasn't really doing anything interesting. I sat around basically doing absolutely nothing of use or of interest to me for like 4 to 6 months. And I realized like, I'm really bored. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I realized I didn't have a big project. I didn't have anything I was working towards. I didn't have anything pushing me to do anything really. So for me, I decided to write a book. And like, you want to talk about stress, like There's one. To me, that was a good sort of stress. Because it pushed me along. Now, at the end of writing a book, as I know you've done too, it kind of starts to tip into the bad stress a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. Especially the marketing part for me. Oh. I was like, I don't know how to do this.
No, it's awful. You've spoken before about this idea of acute versus chronic stress. And I can maybe kind of guess about that, but why don't you tell us, what does all that mean? Like, what is acute and what is acute stress? What is chronic stress?
Yeah. So I think before diving into the differences of those, we have to sort of tell the truth about the fact that our emotional, mental life is very integrated into our bodies. So we don't really have these dichotomies between emotional health and physical health, or mental health and physical health. It's just all one system. So when we're talking about stress, we are talking about how the body responds to elevated stimulus, which sounds not very sexy, but we have these amazing bodies that are hardwired to protect us in the event of stress, right? You can think of the fight or flight. Mm-hmm. How do you, when you're threatened, your heart rate elevates, your breathing becomes faster, it moves into your chest, your muscles become tense, you're ready to get some shit done. Or run for your life, either way.
I mean, whichever.
So that is the perfect use of acute stress. Something is threatening, something is in your face, something is elevated, and your body needs to live in a different space for a short period of time to respond. When that process goes on too long, when we live at a constant state of elevated stimulus, when the demands that we experience in our lives are beyond what we can meet, then we move into chronic stress. And frankly, it tears apart our bodies, because we're just not meant to live in that elevated place. So our muscles are sore, we get heart disease, we get, our breathing is never calm, we never relax, our bodies don't learn to relax. So again, acute stress is the perfect physiological response to something that's threatening. And that can even be an existential threat, like an angry boss or a project that's coming up. It's not always a tiger. It's something that we need to gear up for and be all in on, highly focused, pretty adrenaline fueled, usually moving pretty quickly. And it's a great, that's acute stress is sort of how our bodies are meant to react. But again, when that there's a project due every day, or the boss is mad every day, and we're always living in that place, is when we begin to experience a number of physical and mental health problems.
Yeah. I remember towards the end of my couple jobs ago of the burnout job, I was waking up in the middle of the night thinking that my pager was going off. And it never was. But I would still wake up multiple times a night and just bolting awake, sitting up, grabbing my phone and thinking that it had just gone off from a page. And this still actually went on for months afterward.
Wow.
And it's the getting a page, getting that on-call alarm sounds like acute stress. But because that happened so often for me, it actually became chronic stress.
Yeah, absolutely. And our bodies need to relax. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's part of this whole conversation about burnout and stress, is really allowing ourselves safe, quiet spaces where we can reestablish a low baseline heart rate, where our breathing can calm down, where our muscles can relax, and where our mind can be calm and sort of unbothered, I guess.
Yeah. So I had the pleasure of seeing you speak at a conference a while back. And one of the things you did in your talk was, I thought it was pretty interesting. You had us go through a breathing exercise, right there in the conference. I can't even remember which one you did, but I've seen you write about them before as well. What's your favorite breathing exercise to have people just to relax themselves?
I think the simplest one that I often sort of begin as an introduction point is, I just call it 4x4 breath. And it's where you try to breathe in for 4 seconds and then exhale for 4 seconds. So you're slowing down your breathing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're moving your breath both slow and low, so down into your belly button. So if I'm doing this in an event, I'll have people put their hand, their palm over their belly button and see if they can move their hand or even watch their hand move when they inhale. Sort of like picturing your belly getting filled with air like a balloon. Mm-hmm. And then when you exhale, your hand goes back towards your spine because the balloon is deflating.
Yeah.
So low, slow breath is one of the sort of best tools that we have to counteract the stress response in real time. And there's a ton of science behind why it works, but it's not just like a yoga thing or a meditation thing or like a weird sherry thing. Like there's a tremendous amount of research to support that technique is a great one to use.
Yeah. And I can definitely say that it really does work. Like it is incredible how such a simple thing affects you so profoundly.
Yep. And people can, I love that tool because you can do it in a meeting. Yeah, I mean, like, you can do it without people knowing you're doing it.
Right.
It just looks like you're breathing slowly.
I was reading an article you wrote for Stripe's Atlas website a while back, where you mentioned that you've actually done this on stage while giving a talk and people don't notice.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's incredible to me. Like, I'm totally going to do that.
Yeah, like you're doing an intervention on your own self.
Right, like it's great.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty powerful. And it's something that people kind of need to practice. Taking 4 breaths sounds real simple, but like really slowing and lowering. Right. Really doing those 2 things and being able to get there pretty quickly is an important part of this skill. So when someone is trying to work on this, I just recommend people do it 3 times a day, sort of after you eat, before you eat, when you brush your teeth, whatever sort of anchoring event will help you remember to do it regularly for a period of time until the skill becomes muscle memory or a little bit more hardwired.
Yeah, that's great advice. So on that note, I like to ask all my guests to give us something actionable that people can start on today or this week. So for us, if I think I'm experiencing burnout or I'm trying to avoid it, or I'm in the deepest, darkest hole I can find on already, what can I do? What advice would you give?
So the way that you described that, the deepest, darkest hole, I mean, honestly, I would look for a mental health professional. And I think sometimes mental health professionals, therapists, counselors get sort of a bad rap, or there's a lot of stigma perhaps about seeing them, or they can be inconvenient or whatever. But I do think that if you are feeling like you were at the bottom of the hole and you're not sure how to get out, or you don't feel like you can go lay on the beach in Costa Rica, like you need some ideas that are really specific to your situation, like I would get in touch with a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
And there are increasingly people who, you know, will see people via Zoom or via something that makes it easy for your life. You don't necessarily have to go to an office. The other thing that I would do is really to write about how you're feeling. Good old-fashioned journaling can be very therapeutic, certainly in addition to some of the other skills that we've already talked about, like adding a deep breathing practice, like adding a gratitude list at the beginning or end of your day. Those are really simple things. They don't need to take a lot of time. They're free. They're not expensive. Yep. But they can really move the needle in terms of you feeling a little bit more in control over what's happening inside of you.
All right, then. Yeah, that's fantastic advice. So, Sherry, this has been an absolute pleasure talking with you today. Like, this has been great. I love everything you've said.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
Yeah, so I live online largely at zenfounder.com. So my podcast is called Zen Founder, and we talk about lots of topics like this, work, family life, mental health kinds of issues. I also have a book called The Entrepreneur's Guide to Keeping Your Shit Together, which I'm told is relevant for people who are not only entrepreneurs, but anybody who's really doing
I've read the book. Yeah. It is a wonderful book.
Oh, thank you. I have a guide to stress that Stripe put out that is that you can put in the show notes, that's, you know, free and available. Oh. And I think a helpful tool. So I love doing this. I love that I get to do this. And so I also work one-on-one with people. If people want to reach out to me about some consulting work or doing a talk at your company or whatever, this is my jam. So happy to help.
All right. Well, thank you. And thanks for all you listeners. Thanks for listening to the Real World DevOps Podcast. If you want to stay up to date on the latest episodes, you can find us at realworlddevops.com and on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever it is you get your podcasts. I'll see you in the next episode.
This has been a Humble Pod production.
Stay humble.